Kirchner.
Good morning. May it please the court, Phil Kircher for the petitioners, Dauphin and Bradbury and Robert J. Bradbury. This is an SEC Rule 10b-5 and Section 17a case that arises out of a SEC civil proceeding. The only issue in the case is whether the SEC demonstrated through substantial evidence that Bradbury acted with scienter in the form of a reckless disregard for disclosure of what became known as the PennDOT information. In 2004, this court decided Howard versus SEC, which is cited numerous times in our opening and reply briefs. That too was a Rule 10b-5 and Section 17a case, but it involved recklessness in the form of aiding and abetting an alleged 10b-5 violation. The Howard court found the following, and that was that the SEC's conclusion regarding recklessness as it relates to Ciener was, quote, confused and confusing, end quote. That court found that the SEC disregarded evidence tending to show that Howard, the petitioner in that case, had not acted recklessly. The Howard court noted that the SEC had incorrectly applied a, quote, should have known, end quote, standard when it said it was applying actual subjective awareness of wrongdoing. The Howard court found that the SEC produced no substantial evidence of any awareness of wrongdoing on Mr. Howard's part, and accordingly it reversed the SEC and vacated the SEC order. There are striking similarities between that case, the Howard case, and this case. Three things that come to mind, some of them are maybe footnote material, but in that case, Mr. Howard was on vacation at critical times, and the SEC thought that was a major factor in finding recklessness. In this case, Mr. Bradbury was himself on vacation for 3 or 4 days during the time that the bond prospectus, the official statement, was being drafted. In the Howard case, Mr. Howard was accused of just skimming the prospectus. The same in this case. Mr. Bradbury was accused of not even reading it, although there was testimony to support the fact that he did read the OS in draft form. In the Howard case, the SEC relied exclusively on a should have known, must have known, should have realized, had to have known kind of approach. And it's the same in this case. There is no direct evidence that Mr. Bradbury, in this case, actually knew or believed or was suggested to him that failing to disclose the PennDOT information was skating on thin ice. There is no direct evidence of that. It's all circumstantial. And in this case, as in the Howard case, and this is in the SEC.
How would you establish direct evidence of that, that he knew that he was skating on thin ice?
A memo, an email, testimony of bond counsel that he discussed with Mr. Bradbury. Maybe we should disclose the PennDOT information, and Bradbury's response was, no, I don't think we have to. Okay. There's nothing like that in this case. There is no testimony that any of the professionals, bond counsel, underwriters counsel, the authority that was the issuer, and all of their professionals, the financial advisor, no one ever discussed with Mr. Bradbury whether the PennDOT information should be disclosed or not. There's no email, there's no testimony, there's no letter, there's nothing. And so they proceed on this, well, it was so obvious that it should have been disclosed, he should have disclosed it. That's not Ciener, not in this circuit. That's not the severe kind of recklessness and the subject.
But isn't the underwriter the one that's supposed to be initiating these sorts of conversations? You're saying no one around him is talking about it. Isn't that his job?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And if he doesn't do that, that might be some form of negligence. It might even be severe negligence, but it's not Ciener. In this case, Mr. Bradbury involved himself with the same set of professionals, the lawyers, in terms of two prior bond sales that year, within 6 or 12 months of this bond sale. And since this was the third one involving the same professionals, he essentially turned things over to bond counsel and underwriters counsel. He knew they were discussing what should be disclosed and what should not be disclosed. And the prior two deals involved, it was almost identical. They were Pennsylvania state agencies that bought office buildings that had to fill those office buildings with other Pennsylvania state agencies. And in those...
There's one major difference here, right?
There is. There's no question.
PennDOT information.
There's no question that PennDOT was the 800-pound gorilla. There's no question. And in terms of Mr. Bradbury's subjective belief, and he testified and the others testified to this, there was negative information. In other words, PennDOT was planning to move in a couple of years, but there was also positive information. PennDOT wasn't the tenant. The Department of General Services, which negotiates all agency leases, DGS was the tenant. And they had told everybody publicly, this was in the newspapers, we like this building and we're going to fill it for the next 20 years. Now, was it an ironclad commitment? Not in any way. But that was what was in Bob Bradbury's mind. And he simply assumed that the professionals regarding disclosure had the same information, which they did, and they chose not to specifically...
Wait. His lawyer never had the information. The fellow who drafted the offering statement never had the information.
That's true, Your Honor. That was Mr. O'Neill's testimony. He did not recall having the PennDOT information. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bradbury testified he did not recall giving him that information. What he testified to, though, is the first thing he did when he retained Mr. O'Neill as counsel was to direct him to Mr. Sweet and Mr. Fowler, who live in Harrisburg, to discuss disclosure issues. And those individuals knew the PennDOT information.
Neither of whom bear the same responsibilities as the underwriter, right?
That's true.
Okay.
That's true. As I was saying, the Howard case, I think, provides guidance for this case.
So we're really talking about a difference between negligence and recklessness, right?
Absolutely.
And the standard for recklessness is extreme departure from the standards of ordinary care.
And has also been described as a conscious disregard right. for
and
adequate disclosure.
That's not a decision that we have to make, is it? That's a decision that the SEC made, and our review is simply whether they were crazy to do that, right? Whether there was nothing in the record that would support that. That's the only question before us, right?
That is true. Okay. Whether there's a rational connection. Absolutely.
We don't have to agree with them. We just
you don't. Okay. And just as the Howard case strongly disagreed with the SEC's conclusion of Siena and Howard, my hope is that the same rigor will be applied here. There is simply no evidence. Beyond perhaps negligence, which we're not contesting here. We contested that downstairs. But the knowledge that Bradbury had to have had that he was skating on thin ice, that there might be a problem here, that maybe he should think about it, there is nothing in the record to support that. Nothing. And those who did have to think about it, Mr. Sweet, the bond counsel, the authority, the issuer, Mr. Fowler, the advisor, they all had that information and they all concluded it did not have to be disclosed. And that's what Mr. Bradbury was relying upon. And I went through the litany in the reply brief of all the evidence that shows he couldn't possibly be trying to fool people. He bought the bonds, his best customers bought the bonds, the bank on whose board bought the bonds, and so on and so forth. It's all utterly inconsistent with some kind of subjective state of mind that I'm going to fool somebody here.
Well, but his own purchase of the bonds, which is the most extreme case in the list you just gave, is not inconsistent with a should-have-known standard, right?
It's not inconsistent with a should-have-known standard. That's true, Your Honor, but the should-have-known standard has been rejected by this court. Actually, the most stark evidence of a lack of recklessness or scienter here is the fact that of the four investors who bought, the largest investor, Putnam, who bought $27 million worth of bonds, there is no dispute in the record that Mr. Bradbury disclosed the PennDOT information to that investor, and then the investor bought anyway. If he was skating on thin ice and wanted to keep this hidden, why would he tell the largest investor? And there's no dispute about that. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry to take you back to such a basic point, but you say we've rejected the should-have-known standard. But we're talking about here, what was the SEC, extreme negligence, is that right? Or
recklessness.
So extreme recklessness does not imply actual knowledge, does it?
Your Honor, I think the law says that it implies some subjective state that I'm being risky here, that I'm on thin ice, and I may have to think about this. Now, whether it requires actual intent, no. The Supreme Court has said it's tantamount to fraud. It's not quite there, but it is not a form of negligence. I would agree, Your Honor, you can't stick your head in the ground and ignore facts, but that's not this case.
I guess our own cases say must have known, right?
I think the Howard case rejected must have known, should have known, as opposed to did know. And the did know is, did he have a subjective state of mind that this is risky, that I'm doing something that might be improper? And the evidence is just to the contrary. He got a draft bond counsel opinion that told him the disclosure is adequate without the PennDOT information.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Rada Potts, and I represent the Securities and Exchange Commission. Petitioner's attack on the commission's determination that they acted with scienter is founded primarily on four fallacies, which ran throughout their briefs and today's argument. The first fallacy is the assertion that must have known does not equal scienter. That is not the law. Proof of actual intent to defraud is not necessary to establish extreme recklessness. Instead, as this court has stated, when a defendant gazes upon a specific and obvious danger, a court can infer that the defendant was aware of that danger and therefore possessed the requisite subjective intent necessary for a finding of scienter.
Do you agree with, I think what counsel is saying is, subjective good faith is inherently inconsistent with a finding of recklessness.
I don't completely agree with that, Your Honor. There are instances where white heart, empty head good faith is in fact inconsistent, as stated in Sunstrand, which was of course adopted in Stedman. But here, there was no white heart, empty head good faith. And that takes me to the second point. The commission went far beyond the obvious danger of misleading investors when it made its scienter determination. In fact, it marshaled strong evidence that Mr. Bradbury was consciously aware of the danger and simply ignored it, which leads me to the two fallacies about his good faith. He states that the commission's conclusion is undermined by the comfort Mr. Bradbury took in the swing space possibility and the so-called illogic of his intending to have misled his bread and butter customers. But at the core of these misconceptions is an assumption. And that assumption is that although Bradbury may have been initially concerned about the move, the swing space possibility gave him comfort about investment risk. Therefore, he could not have, and indeed would not have, intended to mislead his bread and butter customers about this investment. But that's beside the point. The question isn't whether Mr. Bradbury thought that this investment was a good bet. Although he had nothing even approaching a firm commitment that any qualified tenant would replace PennDOT, much less at an appropriate rate, although he testified he did not know how long the swing space possibility might go on, although he testified that this was information that he heard secondhand, and although the details were vague, he may well have still been comfortable with the investment risk. But that doesn't mean he did not know the consequences of withholding the move information from investors. He had to have known that what he needed to know to make the assessment he made was the move information and the swing space possibility. But he deprived investors of the move information. And he must have known that without the move information, investors could not make an assessment of whether this investment was within their risk tolerance level or the comfort they might take from the swing space possibility or any possibility of future occupancy. In fact, the strongest evidence that he was consciously aware of the danger and did not act in good faith is his interactions with investors that the commission talks about at pages 10 to 11 and 19 of the commission's opinion. At least three investors, McCormick, Lowe, and Sherman, asked Mr. Bradbury questions or raised concerns that must have demonstrated to Mr. Bradbury that they did not know about the move, that the move information was important to them, and that they would be misled without the information.
I'd like to go just to materiality.
Actually, Your Honor, his argument is that he really did not know, he had a subjective good faith that this didn't need to be disclosed because, well, it wasn't important, or he balanced the swing space possibility.
I don't understand how the testimony of the purchasers can serve to establish his scienter as opposed to the materiality, which isn't in dispute here.
I think it is the interactions he had with the investors. When investors asked him questions that demonstrated to him, for example, when Sherman said to him, when Sherman was asked, did you ask Dolphin and Bradbury how long PennDOT would be in the building? Sherman did not reply that Bradbury told him, oh, PennDOT's going to move in a couple years. No, Sherman testified Bradbury didn't tell him about that. But what did Bradbury?
I thought all the evidence was that when people asked for this information, he gave it to them.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. And
that's not. Is this the only exception, Sherman?
I'm sorry?
Is Sherman the only exception?
No. Indeed, Mr. Keith Lowe as well. And that's detailed.
And are there others where he was asked and did give the information? I thought there were.
Keith Lowe and Mr. Sherman. He was asked questions that should have elicited the move information, and instead of replying with the move information, he replied with the swing space possibility.
My question is whether there were other people who asked the same question and got the more
fulsome
answer.
Ms. McCormick of Putnam, which opposing counsel referred to. And in fact, that was the only person that he told about the move, and she testified that that was part of an iterative process. Ms. McCormick was quite dogged in her pursuit of information. And she would ask a question as she testified, then ask another question and another question and so forth. And this is what elicited the move information from Mr. Bradbury. What this shows, according to the commission on page 19, is that Bradbury's responding to these inquiries with the swing space possibility shows that Bradbury actually believed that the future occupancy of Forum Place was important to investors. And it puts the lie to his repeated assertion that he believed that the move did not need to be disclosed because it was too speculative. If anything, it was the swing space possibility that was subject to many, many contingencies that was speculative, not the move. So realizing that this information was so important, petitioners speculate that Bradbury did talk to Lowe and Sherman about the move. But that has no basis in the record. What the record shows is that the potential loss of tenants was something that elicited general inquiry and sometimes specific inquiry about the building's future occupancy. But it also shows that only McCormick was aware of the move, and that's because there's a big difference between the potential loss of a tenant and actually knowing that the tenant plans to move. Finally, I'd like to touch on the fourth fallacy, and that is that reliance on the silence of others somehow establishes good faith here. While there might be circumstances in which that might be true, it's not true here. The silence of other people did not erase what Mr. Bradbury knew. It does not establish good faith, certainly not white heart, empty head good faith. And in terms of O'Neill.
Your target here is must have known, right?
Must have known.
How is that different from should have known?
As this court explained in Saba v. Compagnie Nationale Air France, which is the case that I, that helps me understand it best, and that is cited in Wansover at 205 Fed 3rd 408 414 to 15. The way the court described it in Saba is that there are two types of recklessness, and one type is just an extension of gross negligence, and that is not sufficient for scienter. The second type has an element of subjective intent, but as the Saba court stated, that element can be satisfied simply by showing that the conscious attention of a person was drawn to a danger, and therefore you can infer that they knew about the danger, and absent some, and therefore possess the requisite subjective intent. Absent some indication of some more than flimsy basis for believing that the move information wasn't important and need not be disclosed to investors, Bradbury cannot claim that he had the sort of good faith that pushes this simply into an extension of gross negligence.
So conscious attention drawn to the danger, right?
Yes.
That's what you want to say.
Yes.
And how is that consistent with his having purchased and caused his bank to purchase significant portions of the bonds?
Well, I tried to explain that earlier, Your Honor. Let me try it a different way. Say that someone goes to get a loan from a bank, and they truly believe they can pay off this loan. And they tell the bank everything. Everything they tell the bank is true, except one thing. They make $100,000 a year, and they tell the bank that they make $200,000 a year. Have they acted with subjective intent, even if they believe that they truly can pay it off and that they...
Let's deal with an omission.
Okay.
Makes it a little more
difficult. This omission is the same thing.
No, that was a misrepresentation.
Okay, but this omission rendered, Your Honor, existing representations misleading. That is a misrepresentation.
You're looking at the effect on the audit, on the person listening. I want to know how it reflects back on the scienter of the person speaking or failing to speak.
Actually. Okay. He knew that the move was important to him. He knew that the move was important to other people. He said to himself, well, I've balanced the swing space possibility. I'm comforted. But that has no basis. It is a contingency. Yes, indeed, DGS.
But he put his money there, right?
I'm sorry?
He put money on that. He invested.
You know, many gamblers lose money on their investments. And it is very common, Your Honor, in the securities area for people to say, I thought it was a good investment. I didn't think this risk would materialize. But in fact, you know, the anti-threat...
It takes some doing to lose money on municipal bonds. I mean, the default rate is pretty favorable.
But I think the point is, he knew the information he needed to assess the risk. He didn't let investors have that. And I think that is quintessential fraud. And again, had he had some significant basis for the belief he had, perhaps that would establish white heart, empty head, good faith. But here his head was full. He knew, and he just decided that he would choose for investors. And that is not consistent with the securities laws, and it's not consistent with having acted merely grossly negligently.
But the process of disregarding this information, both in failing to disclose it and in going forward with his own investment, suggests, does it not, a thought process of something like, well, I'm aware of that, but I don't think it's significant.
He gambled. You know, different people have different risk tolerances.
Gamble isn't helpful in this context.
Well, I think it is.
Every investment has some risk.
Actually, I think it is, Your Honor, because these risks were huge. PennDOT was, as he states, the 800-pound gorilla, 300,000 square feet of office space in that building, 60% of the revenues in that building. Adams of DGS testified that in any given year, only 10 to 20,000 square feet of office space in the governmental tenancies would come up for tenants, 10 to 20,000. That would have only filled one third, I believe, of the space. And this swing space was not funded. I mean, that's a huge contingency. Now, he may have believed that it would be funded, but absent some greater indication, that belief was reckless, Your Honor.
What does the record reflect of, or say about the attitude of the tenant to the change in management of the building?
You mean the tenants that were there after?
The GSA equivalent.
Oh, okay. Well, of course.
I mean, his claim is in part, you know, look, right, none of this would have happened if the bozos in the city council hadn't changed the management and driven the tenant out.
Well, with the caveat that the Scienter inquiry is prospective looking, not retrospective, I would say that, you know, there is a chance that perhaps they mismanaged this building, but that's not really relevant to
this
inquiry.
Well, I'm just asking what the record says about it.
The record, there are a number of minutes of meetings that petitioners did include in the record, and they suggest that the new board tried to get a higher lease rate than what was really appropriate.
And fired the manager.
Yes, they fired Mr. Barton.
And later rehired.
And yes, and later
filled the building up.
I'm sorry?
And refilled the building.
No, actually the building still is partially empty as I understand it, Your Honor. But, and that's extra record, and that's obviously also not part of the inquiry. Right. But I would say this, what he took comfort in was not that certain agencies would come and fill the space. What he took comfort in was the so-called swing space possibility, the use of the space as temporary space while buildings were renovated. That is a different contingency. And he in the briefs, it is inconsistently dealt with. Because swing space is one thing, regular space is another thing. And I would just finally say this. Add up all the contingencies for swing space, the funding, the fact that you would have to go out with an RFP. Okay, you couldn't just, Kroll could not just have said, I'm going to put them in. He would have had to go out with an RFP because this is a private building. Okay, Forum Place might.
You say if the GSA equivalent agency has a lease on the building, and they want to renew the lease, they have to go out with an RFP?
That's not their lease. It is their lease only in this sense. PennDOT is the occupant, and the lease is with PennDOT acting through DGS. DGS functioned as a real estate agent, or if you will, it did sign the lease, that's true. And to some extent, it was considered the lessee. But the lease, and I think that this is what Mr. Kroll testified to and what Mr. Adams testified to of DGS, is that the lease was with the agency acting through DGS, okay? And agencies, as Adams and Kroll testified, agencies were the moving force for the sort of lease. They really, although they had the theoretical possibility that they could force an agency to go in a particular building, my understanding is they'd never used it, that the agency specified what they needed, when they needed, how they needed it. And even in this swing space possibility, Kroll testified that he would have to go out with an RFP. Now, it's possible that he could rent the space under the DGS moniker, but because it was a private space, he would have to go out. So funding, RFP, and moreover, he stated that if he was going to use space, he'd have to use state space before he used private space. And with the building of the Keystone Building, which was 100,000 square feet larger than the building it replaced, 105, I believe, there was additional space freed up in some state agency buildings to move into Keystone. So that freed up some swing space. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Price. Give you a minute, Mr. Kirshner.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
1 minute for rebuttal?
1 minute?
You're out of time otherwise. So.
Okay. Very quickly, then, you asked the question, Your Honor, the attitude of the tenant. There's no question the record reflects the tenant was DGS. It's not the agency, and the ALJ so found. And the attitude of the tenant, the only written record of that is reflected in two pieces of evidence. The newspaper article, which Mr. Kroll testified was accurate, and that was he loved the building and he wanted to fill it for the next 15 to 20 years, regardless of what PennDOT's plans were. The second piece is the minutes of the meeting of the authority in which Mr. Kroll basically made the same statement, and that was reported back to Mr. Bradbury during the drafting of the OS. Obviously, this court, this panel understands this case very well on the single issue, and I'll just sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Ms. Potts, thank you. Case is submitted.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned.